Good morning and welcome to the Albany Report. I'm your host, former State Senator Cecilia Kacik, and it's the first day of winter. We finally got some cold weather, and I hope everyone's has all their plans ready for the holidays coming up. And I have a great show today that I'm really excited about our guest. With talking to us today about corruption in New York State is going to be Professor Zephyr Teachout. She's a law professor at Fordham Law School and wrote the book Corruption in America. And she ran for governor. She was a candidate for governor last year against Governor Andrew Cuomo and won almost 30% of the primary votes. She ran without much money and name recognition and did extraordinarily well. We're going to be talking to her in just a few minutes about what she thinks needs to happen. I think the halls of Albany have been shaken to the core with the corruption trials and convictions for both former Speaker of the Assembly, Sheldon Silver, and former Majority Leader of the Senate, Dean Skelos. Both were found guilty of corruption and bribery charges brought by U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And I, like many, are very grateful for the work that the U.S. Attorney has done to really shed a light on how Albany functions and the corruption and pay-to-play system that we currently have that needs to be changed. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. That'll start in just a few minutes. And some of the news that's coming out of Albany is the governor has decided to move the State of the State address. Typically, he does this on the first day of session in front of the legislature. Historically, he used to go, the governor would go to the assembly hall and lay down his agenda for the year and speak to the legislators. He's moved it to January 13th and will be combining it with his presentation on the state budget. He did that last year because of the death of his father. He's doing it again. I really am troubled by this change. This is not, I think, good, because the State of the State is where you present your agenda and things your goals for the year. It's really separate from the budget. And the budget process is very long, very detailed, and there's a lot of information that gets put in the budget. And clearly, you know, by combining the two, I think we don't have a chance to really get a handle on what the governor's, you know, thoughts are on changes he'd like to see and things he'll be pushing. And it gives us less time to review things like his agenda and what that might bode for the budget. So I don't think it's a good idea for the public, but no one asked my opinion. So this will be an interesting year. And one of the things the governor has said is he will be coming up with an ethics reform package that he'll be pushing. I don't know what's changed in his mind, but clearly the public is more aware of this pay-to-play system and will be looking for how he is going to move the ethics reform agenda forward. So we're going to take a little break and hopefully get our guest on the phone. I'm going to play in her honor, because we're going to be talking about corruption in America, a video song. It's called Money is Speech. I've played this before on our show, a musical history of campaign finance. And if you listen carefully, you'll hear different folks like President Nixon, even President Obama and President Clinton are quoted in the song. Their words are heard. Anyway, here's Money is Speech, a musical history of campaign finance by ProPublica.
But in all of my years of public life, I have never profited. Never profited. I've earned every cent.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
Money is speech.
I've earned every cent.
Money is speech. The more speech, the better.
I don't like all the influence of money in politics.
When people think of Watergate, they think of a break-in, but they don't mention the money that Nixon was taking from wealthy donors to help him get re-elected. Nixon paid him back in favors just like they expected. To battle corruption, Congress passed a new law, capping contributions to a candidate's hall. The source of the donations had to be disclosed too, and the SEC was formed to enforce the new rules. Some who felt the law went against the Constitution sued, saying limits on money limited free speech too. So the courts kept the cap on how much you can donate, but said spending was unlimited by an outside group that made no more spending limits to promote a cause or to point out a rival campaign's flaws. So while candidates will suck around with brown paper bags, from then on they raise money publicly or left it to pack.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
Money is speech.
I've earned every cent.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
I don't like all the influence of money in politics.
We should also curb the role of big money in elections by capping the cost of campaigns. And we should also curb the role of big money in elections by capping the cost of campaigns.
Now in the 80s and 90s, there was a new gimmick. Soft money that's disclosed but had no limits. It's supposed to cover each party's expenses, but guys like Clinton used it to help their election chances. There was just one problem. Clinton's party was broke, so he asked for more money every time he spoke. And in return for the $100 million cash in, he let donors use a Lincoln bedroom to crash in. Then the scandal and reform cycle happened again, and legislation was proposed by Golden McCain. It capped donations to parties, indexed soft funds, and banned corporate union issue ads right before elections. But with each new reform comes new loopholes. Tax-exempt 527s arose because they weren't explicit about whom they supported. Many still raise money without limits to thwart them.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
Money is speech.
I've earned every cent.
Money is speech.
The more speech, the better.
The rules are what they are.
I don't think.
By capping the cost of campaigns. And
I don't think American elections should be bankrolled by America's most powerful interest.
But the most outside money was yet to be spent. Some argued spending limits broke the First Amendment. Corporations and unions are entitled to free speech. They took it to court. The Supreme Court agreed. Super PACs can raise as much money as they want. They can also use union and corporate funds. The only rule is that they cannot coordinate with a specific party or a specific candidate. But reform opponents were quite done, yet they found new uses for 501c4 nonprofits. Which are a lot like super PACs with more mystery. They haven't had to disclose donors ever in history. Whether Republican or Democrat, you might believe that spending limits jeopardize the freedom of speech. But with each new cycle of deregulation, more money's being injected into our elections.
I don't think
by capping the cost of campaigns.
And that was Money is Speech, a musical history of campaign finance. I'm going to put that video up on the Albany Report's Facebook page because I just think it's fascinating how when you put video to the historical perspective of money and speech, that it's a fun video, but it's quite disturbing. And I want to talk about money and is speech and the role of money in our political system and the pay-to-play atmosphere now in Albany. And joining me this morning is Professor Zephyr Teachout. Professor, can you hear me?
I hear you loud and clear.
Excellent. Sorry about the technical difficulties, but this is community radio, and
absolutely,
sometimes things don't go right or as planned. So welcome to the Albany Report.
Oh, I'm really excited to be on, and you're one of my money and politics reform heroes, so I'm excited to be talking to you about this.
Well, thank you. The feeling is mutual. And why did you decide to run for governor? Let's start with that.
Oh, we're going there. I thought I would do a better job than Andrew Cuomo.
Well,
I actually do think it's that simple sometimes, and I've spent a lot of energy in the last year and a few months recruiting people to run, and I will say that especially women, but a lot of people have a very high standard of what they think they have to be before they run for office, but your job is really to say, is it something I'd enjoy doing, and do I think I would do a better job than the person there? It doesn't have to be that negative. In Andrew Cuomo's case, I had some real... There was a final straw. I actually really supported him in 2010. I volunteered for him. I was excited about his Clean Up Albany message. And then there were a series of decisions that he made around education policy, tax policy that I really disagreed with. But I will say the final straw was in spring of 2014 when he didn't push for... actual public financing of elections, which I think is absolutely fundamental for revolution, changing the culture of Albany, and actually leading to, you know, greater democracy and self-government, and instead shut down the Moreland Commission. So there were these sort of two real, I thought, perplexing and indefensible moves, and that was the final straw for me for deciding to run.
Well, we're certainly glad you did, and it certainly brought the issue to the forefront, and you know, how did you do in the primary? You ended up with almost 30%?
No, it was over 30%, and we won over half the counties, which was very exciting. Actually, you know, we did fairly well. We did better upstate than in the city. And I found, actually, where we could get air, where we sort of got oxygen, because a lot of running for office, as you know fairly well, is the first step is just letting people know that you exist. And I have this funny name, so we would joke that my first step was letting people know that I was a person, not an app, and then that I was a woman, and then that I was, you know, serious and sort of understood the policy, you know, the policy threats. But, like, in Albany County, we actually won 58%.
That's right.
Of the vote. And in the surrounding counties, you know, 70%. In Rensselaer, it was 61. So I don't know how far your listenership goes, but I know I have a lot of support up there, and I really appreciated it.
Well, at least they could spell your name. Mine was a little more challenging.
Your name is so hard.
So when I first ran for the Senate, you know, it didn't matter how much that I needed a lot of money. I wanted change, and I wanted someone to represent the voices that were not being heard in Albany. And money be damned. And I actually won in 2012 with no name recognition and not much money. And it was, and I agree with you, more people should run, more women should run, and I think our democracy is better for it when we have people engaged and involved at that level.
And what was so exciting about your race is that there's this conventional wisdom that yeah, people gripe about their elected officials, but they don't really want to hear about corruption, and the solutions are too complicated. We can't talk about public financing of elections. It's too hard. And what, I mean, you ran on a whole bunch of issues, but you really showed, and I think it had real national, I know it had real national impact, that you showed that that is a winnable issue, and that people do care, and that maybe they didn't 20 years ago, but right now there's an incredible hunger for people talking about real solutions and not just accepting the status quo.
Well, I think the corruption trials for the former Speaker of the Assembly and former Majority Leader of the Senate, and that they were found guilty, and the information that came out of those trials only steers the more sunshine into the whole process and system that our government is functioning in. And I think we really have to take a look at it and say, this is wrong, folks. Is there anything in the trials that came out that surprised you?
I first just want to emphasize what you just said. It's that this is an immoral system. It's not just sort of a technically wrong thing. It's an immoral system, and it leads to immoral results because it means that people's voices truly are not heard and that instead government becomes a tool, and they're wonderful, wonderful elected officials, but as an overall system, increasingly it becomes a tool of a few big companies and big people who want to, wealthy people who want to extract money out of the, take our tax money fundamentally. And that one sort of meta thing I would say about the trials is that although Skillis and Silver were found guilty, the other major character in the trials was Glenwood Management, which is a New York City luxury developer. If you've been to New York City recently, there are all these huge, huge buildings that have shot up in the last 5 or 6 years, and they've gotten unbelievable tax breaks. Basically, they're handed cash. This company, Glenwood Management, is handed cash to build these buildings. A lot of times, people don't even live in them. They just use them as investments. And then in both of these trials, this luxury developer, Glenwood Management, was front and center as the quote-unquote victim, but basically the other party to the conspiracy. Glenwood Management, for instance, had repeat conversations with Skelos about their need for tax breaks, and in exchange, Skelos' son got a no-show job making lots and lots of money. One of the things that I think is really important is the trials are really different, even though they have the same character. Skelos' trial was just more sort of a ham-handed, blundering politician making, it's sort of obviously criminal and kind of stupid deals with Glenwood and others. And in Silver's trial, I actually think Silver's trial is more important because it's more, it's closer to what is already happening in Albany and in Washington all the time, where there aren't these sort of crude threats, but basically Silver is, through a complicated scheme, taking 400,000, you know, million, hundreds of thousands of dollars from, again, this luxury developer in exchange for pushing their tax policy. And he doesn't make the explicit deal. He doesn't say, hey, I'll get you your tax policy if you give me this cash. So it's a lot closer to what, unfortunately, happens every day with campaign donors.
It sure does. And during session, I mean, every day, people are visiting your office. Lobbyists are talking to you. They're in the halls of the Capitol, grabbing you as you come off the elevator. And then at night, you have the fundraisers.
Yeah.
So well, you
yeah,
see.
Talk about your experience with this. I'd be really interested to hear.
Well, it's fascinating that, you know, I think the trial showed what really goes on in Albany. Mm-hmm. But it's, as you said, it's not clearly obvious. You know, it's hidden. It's secretive. It's, you know, you're not going to find a paper trail.
So let's say I'm you and you're a lobbyist. What would our conversation look like to?
Well, you would make an appointment. You'd come in the office, and then you would talk about your issue, and we would get information, and I'd learn about it. And, you know, just because you're a lobbyist doesn't mean you're not giving me good information.
Right.
And not all lobbyists are out to, you know, scam the system.
Right.
But there is a clear pay-to-play culture in Albany, and it's much easier to get your voice heard and your agenda pushed if behind that request and that information is a huge pile of campaign cash.
Yeah.
And that's just an obvious thing. And you can see that in the last year, in the first day of session, the Senate Republicans put on the floor this tax credit bill for education investment tax credit that gave back 90% of your tax liability if you donated to, you know, a school that through a complicated scheme helps private schools and religious schools. It was kind of a backdoor way to privatize education and fund religious schools. And they're giving back 90%. It was ludicrous. They passed that bill before the governor even, you know, did his state of the state. I think this was last year.
Right.
And to me, that's how you get your message heard. That's not the most important issue in public education today. It's about, we should be talking about the inequity in public education.
Yeah.
But because of the enormous amount of money that is going to this education investment tax credit, that's the issue that gets debated and pushed.
Well, it's also a great example for the other reason you mentioned, which is that it's a complicated issue. It's a complicated sentence. The way in which the money is taken out and basically, you know, from a distance, if you're looking at it from space, you basically see money going from public schools to billionaires and millionaires' pockets. But if you're up close, it's this complicated scheme, as you were saying. And as John Oliver said, if you want to do something really evil, make it really boring. but increasingly, a lot of the bodies are buried in the tax code or in bills that sound really complicated, and that's on purpose. And I think it's really, it can become hard but really important then to pay attention to the tax fights in particular.
Conversations in the Skelos trial that Gene Skelos had with his son Adam was about power. in the legislature, he said to his son, I control everything.
Yeah.
I control who gets chairs the committee. I control the committee agendas. I control what bills get to the floor. That amount of power in one person is where we get a lot of the corruption. Your rank and file, you know, legislators like me, we're not the problem. It's
explain again. I think it's really useful to hear from the inside what this real difference in power feels like and how it affects your ability to push things that you care about.
Well, one of the things that because the leader holds so much power, because if you control the process, you control what bills get to the floor.
Yes.
And that power means that they can stop anything.
Yep.
Even bills that have a majority of sponsors on them,
yep.
Like the bill to take toxic chemicals out of plastic toys so that babies don't suck on them.
Yep.
I mean, that's just common sense absurdity that we don't make sure that toys in our stores that we're marketing to very small children and babies,
yeah.
The parents are not warned that, okay, this is something that you don't want to let your baby chew on, because that's what babies do.
Yeah.
And there were, I think, this past session, 40 co-sponsors. That's more than a majority in the Senate.
Yeah.
But it could not get to the floor because someone's stopping it. Clearly, that person is the leader,
yeah.
Who is stopping it. And they're stopping it for what reason? Take a guess. Yeah.
That's a great example, but I don't know who the donors are in this situation.
Well, I think one way to, I think we see how the system is stopping democracy from happening. Because when you have more than a majority of co-sponsors,
yeah.
You have Republican and Democrats on that bill. You have the public has reached out to their representatives. They've said, this is a bill that we want you to support.
Yeah.
That's democracy in action. And you have a leader saying, no, you don't know why. But I think one way to kind of shed the light on that process would be to have each bill list, because you can get the information, and this is public, what the bill is about. There's a sponsor's memo that explains it.
Mm-hmm.
You have the history of the bill. You have who's a co-sponsor. Let's put on that memorandum of information that the legislators get and the public gets who is lobbying on this piece,
yes.
of legislation,
right.
And how much money is going, and where's that money going to? Because suddenly, if you shed the light, because I think that's what we need, if you shed the light on what's happening, it won't happen.
Yeah, I am also a student of history, and what we see in New York is so similar to the kinds of things, actually, that we fought the Revolutionary War about. Because so much of what you see during the Constitutional Convention is a discussion about the way in which unbelievable concentration of power, because that's what you're talking about,
right.
Leads to corruption, and that it's sort of a magnet for it. Because if you know that the speaker has excess power, then all the money and energy is going to flow towards that. And we're not used to organizing, and New York activists have gotten good at this, but we have a long way to go, around bills that don't get to the floor. It's a lot easier to say, wait, you voted against this? I'm gonna run you out of town. But if they never get to the floor, then it's a lot harder to organize around, especially if, say, you're in your district and the reason it isn't getting to the floor is somebody from Long Island. So how do you then, in your district, organize as a citizen who might care about this bill, organize to put pressure on somebody from Long Island? Well, it's hard as a citizen. It's not hard if you have a lot of money.
Right.
And so one of the things that I don't know if your listeners know about, but that Glenwood Management that I mentioned earlier is a downstate company that, it's really city-based. And yet it spends a lot of money in upstate races throughout the state. Not because those senators or assembly members have a direct interest in what building is going to be going up on 42nd Street in New York City, but because basically they want to buy silence and say, don't get engaged on this one. This isn't your issue. You can't do that as a citizen. You can do that as somebody with a lot of money. And that's why it's so important to, I mean, there's so many things we can do in New York. You're talking about disclosure of connecting lobbyists to bills. I think that would be fantastic. I also think it's really important to close the LLC loophole.
Yes.
We call it the LLC loophole, but basically we don't, in New York State, we have our own private Citizens United, which allows, which is legislative, not constitutional, but which allows corporations to give cash donations, not independent spending, contributions to candidates. And the amount of money being spent in that has gone way, 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 way up. And I'm thrilled to see that Syracuse Mayor Stephanie Miner just made an announcement this past Friday saying she's not going to take any direct corporate contributions, and I'd love to see all politicians do that. But this is a bill we could pass this year if Andrew Cuomo wanted to take leadership on it. We could pass, we could stop the LLC loophole. We could basically stop campaign contributions from corporations in New York State.
Well, it's interesting because the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, last week announced that he was giving back money he received from Glenwood Management.
Yes.
About $20,000. Now, I know we have legislators up here that have received money from Glenwood Management's many, many LLCs. Because when you're a real estate developer, every building you build, and he has many of them, and they're high-rise apartments, and they have plenty of money, are listed as a separate LLC, yet they control all of them. So it's like he can funnel money through these different LLCs, and you're not sure where that money's coming from.
Right.
So there's transparency issues. But like my opponent, George Amater, who won the seat back, has been a recipient of Leonard Litwin's LLC money to the tune of, I think it's well over $75,000 over the years.
Now, Amador is kind of a poster child for what we're talking about here, which is, you know, claiming to represent the district, but the donations are coming from a now known briber in New York State politics, Glenwood Litwin and Glenwood Management. And so you have to ask, who's he really representing?
It's kind of related to outside income. That was another way to get money, especially if you were a lawyer. You would put your name on a law firm, and suddenly you would get all this money for doing nothing, because the prestige of having your name attached to that law firm. So it's similar. Like, the bottom line is, who are you working for?
Yep.
And if you are, and I think if we want a government to work for the people, we have to limit the amount of outside income, or eliminate it altogether, and we have to close the LLC loophole that allows wealthy individuals to have undue influence and access through our campaign finance system.
Yeah, and these are. I know if you're in New York, you can feel like, oh, we've been fighting this battle for a long time, and things feel, close to impossible, but both closing the LLC loophole and limiting outside income are actually things that can happen this year. And I think it's, I see two futures. One is, for all Andrew Cuomo says, I don't think he really is a reformer, so I don't think he's going to do this on his own, but he's open to it, unlike other reforms. And I think that if we see real activism around this, these are absolutely winnable issues this year.
Well, it's going to take a lot of effort on the public's part.
Exactly.
Things don't happen in Albany because they should.
Right.
Things happen because we make them happen.
Yes.
And it's really imperative that the public stay engaged and involved on this issue. We've talked a lot about closing the LLC loophole on our show.
Yeah.
I had an interview with Senator Dan Squadron, who was in the minority and trying to get the Elections Committee to just vote on his bill that would do just that. And the election committee punted the bill to another committee. And we have two local members on the elections committee, Senator Kathy Marchione from Columbia County and Senator George Amador.
Yep.
And they both failed to take a position on it. They just voted it out or didn't vote at all on the bill. So they had an opportunity to stand up for the status quo, same pay-to-play system as usual, or to stand up for change and reform and getting government more in the hands of our everyday citizens, and they chose not to do that. I just think it's important for people to remember that.
It's really important, and these are things that they can flip on. I mean, they're upcoming elections, and if they feel like people are paying attention, like there's no justification, whether you're Republican or Democrat, there's no justification for a system that allows corporate contributions. So, and outside income, what's funny about outside income is actually the majority of, the vast majority of representatives and senators don't actually make a lot of money outside. It's just a handful that do. So,
and I got to tell you, having served in the Senate for 2 years,
you
don't have time to do outside jobs.
Right.
I mean, I could do nothing else.
Right.
My district was huge. I was on the road constantly. To say that this is only a part-time job is absurd.
Right. And if you think of the sort of, right, the complexity and importance of issues facing every senator, the idea that that would just be a few months a year and the rest of the time you can, you know, go back and work on your law firm. So if you are serving another master, then is what you're
saying.
Then you actually are serving them in your job as a senator.
Right. You're not working
for
the people if you're doing another job. And then you have all these conflicts of interest.
Yeah.
It's
such human nature. Again, in the Constitutional Convention, the biggest debate, the one they went back and forth on, was whether or not in our new country, people should be allowed to hold elected office in Congress and also have an appointed office, like being having a job as running a post office or something like that. And finally, we have a provision in the U.S. Constitution which forbids holding appointed office and elected office at the same time because of the concern that, the concern was, well, we won't be able to recruit good people to run if they can't hold an outside job. But fundamentally, as George Mason said, this was the cornerstone of the Constitution, the idea that you can't serve two masters at once. And so that's a really deep American principle. And, there is a history of a part-time legislature. It's not where we are now in New York.
No, we have a much more complicated world. I mean, lots of people back then lived on farms, and they went back to take care of the farm.
Yeah.
And we don't have that same society anymore.
Yeah.
And it's much more complicated. We have a lot more people as well. You know, one senator is representing 300,000 people.
Yeah.
And that is a huge responsibility. And frankly, I think they should be working on, you know, the government side and nothing else. It's absurd that we think that this is a part-time job in today's society.
Yeah. And again, of course, at the founding, we have basically 3 million voters in the whole country. So the scale is so, so different.
And I think I've heard, you know, that leaders in the Senate say, well, we like having people with different experience. You don't start out often becoming a politician. You have jobs.
Yeah.
You have a career. At some point, you say, I have enough experience that I think I would do well representing people, and you look at your skill sets, and maybe this makes sense for you as a next step. But to say, if I'm a doctor, I don't take that experience with me if I stop being a doctor, is just ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the skills of a legislator are, you need to be able to listen. You need to be able to process and look at things on a larger scale and see how best to help everyone, because you're representing everyone. That takes a lot of effort and focus. And, you know, we should have more public hearings about controversial issues and reports, so that we're looking and sharing information about, you know, one of the things that I learned is you can't change systems until you understand how they work first.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you don't understand how something works today, what are you going to put in place that's going to improve it? and make it more effective and cost-effective. And that takes a lot of fact-finding and sharing of information. That hasn't been happening, and I found it very frustrating. When I was a legislator, I would go to as many budget hearings as I could, and I was asking questions. And I remember one of the chair of the budget hearing was complaining that I was asking too many questions. But we've got to learn what we're doing before we can propose changes that make sense.
Yeah, well, I do feel like one of the great, you know, ideal roles of a lawmaker is that they're deeply curious, which is part of your point.
Yes.
And a curiosity takes time. It takes understanding the texture of things and not just models of how things might work in the abstract. And I know this is something you've been a real leader on. It's that one of the real tragedies of our current private financing model instead of public financing model is it takes, in some ways, one of our best features is, like, if you're a good listener, if you're really curious, and instead of putting that curiosity and listening towards the people in your district, you're putting that curiosity and listening and energy towards a small spreadsheet of the wealthiest people that you could possibly have access to and learning everything about their lives and everything they care about. And some of them may be great people, but that's not the kind of way in which we want to have curiosity and empathy exercised.
Well, I'll tell you a funny story. I was on the Environmental Conservation Committee, and I wanted to pass a bill that banned fracking waste from coming into New York State, because why would we want to take fracking waste from Pennsylvania and dump it into our landfills and deal with all those potential problems? We didn't allow fracking at the time, and now we don't. And it was voted down in the Environmental Conservation Committee, and the chair said, "I don't think this is happening." And to me, it was just an astounding reflection on, if we don't agree on what the problems are, we'll never agree on what the solutions are, and we have a long way to go. But it's really important for people to be engaged. But the role of the governor on this, too, I think is paramount. And he could have done, we mentioned the LLC loophole, and you said that he's open to it. Well, he has...
Well, the LLC loophole, I'm not sure. I think on part-time, if I might have misspoke, I think on the on banning outside
income. Yes.
I think he's open to that. He keeps slipping back and forth.
He has said that he wants to see the LLC loophole close. He would sign legislation if it reached his desk, and it was held up in the Senate. One of the things that he could do and can do, even during session, is to call a special session.
Yes.
And say, put this on the floor.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I actually think more and more New Yorkers, and especially in your area, are very aware of the fact that he has a tendency to say one thing and then act in another way. So he'll say that he's opposed to the LLC loophole, but then also, or supportive of closing it, but then say these things like, there is no appetite. Now, you learn in English class in high school, that anybody who's using passive language, you want to make sure, where is there no appetite? Who is there no appetite from? And he could really not just answer questions about it, but go on the stump and say, we don't need our own Citizens United in New York State. We can close this. Let's do this now. Let's get this on the agenda. And you know, it's very similar to what he's done with public financing of elections. Is that he's actually, you know, repeatedly said exactly the right thing about it, you know, describing why it's important, but then hasn't pushed to have it in the budget, hasn't pushed to make it a priority. The reason I think, you know, just to get a little strategic, the reason I think even public financing of elections is possible with this governor is that at some point he's not going to run for office again, and he's so dependent on huge, huge, huge private donations. But at the point at which he's not going to run for office again, you would think that he wouldn't mind the people coming after using the public financing system. So, I'd love to put the pressure on so that he'll do it even when he's in office. But certainly for 2020 or sometime in the future, we should be looking for universal public financing.
What are you hoping he'll talk about or propose this session in his... State of the State, if you were governor.
Right.
I'm sure there's things you would propose.
I got a long list, but here's a way in which I would listen and pay attention. There's two things I would pay attention to. One is all the money. His new budget director comes from the
Senate Finance Committee.
Yes.
Rob Majuca has been appointed by Governor Cuomo to be his new budget director.
Right. So the budget is critical. So you look at his new staff changes, and they're really important, and important in a way that I'm not happy about. One is elevating the communications director to chief of staff, which then puts style over substance, basically saying what we say and how we sound is more important. It's the communications arm instead of what we're actually doing. And the second is, you know, bringing over this Republican Republican into the budget director's slot. So that's very troubling to me, because a lot of the concessions he's made in the last year, and they're really, really important concessions. I mean, they're critical, and they're because of activism on fracking, on Fight for 15. These are things where, in general, he hasn't had to actually put a number on it and shift money from the super wealthy New Yorkers, who now pay less in taxes than middle class and poor New Yorkers, hasn't had to shift money. So I'd look for things in which there's actually a change in the wealthiest people paying their fair share and the biggest companies paying their fair share, because right now they're not. So he's always looking for symbolic ways to, quote-unquote, shift to the left, but I would be looking for the substantive ways. And that's true in education policy, for instance, which we both care a lot about. I think it is great and wonderful, and I'm so impressed with the activism around the state that the governor is really dialing back on the use of standardized testing as a way to judge teachers. But we have a long way to go before we've actually funded our schools. You know, just really basic. Kids don't have the funding. They don't have the resources they need. And localities are having to pay enormous amounts to make up for the fact that the state isn't helping out.
Right. If we had more stable funding coming from the state aid portion,
yes,
rather than property taxes, it would even out funding to schools. The schools would have a better chance of getting what they need, and it would reduce local property taxes.
And people are really hurting from their property taxes, as you know.
Absolutely.
And so then they are wanting to reduce them, but taking money out of their own schools. I understand their pain, but the problem is the state. It's not the localities. So I would be looking for money numbers, and that means also in taxes. Again, taxes may sound like, especially at the high end, we want to see whether he's moving towards a progressive taxation system. And then on reform, what's so tricky about him, for the reason you say, is not what he says, but what he does. And so we'll be looking for what he says is going to be a priority and making sure he follows through on that. I think those are really important things. And then energy. You know, I think you and I both sort of see this state as potentially a real leader on renewable energy.
Absolutely.
And he's made a few good moves there, but we're still unfortunately building infrastructure for fracked gas instead of, like, every piece of infrastructure we're building should be moving towards renewable energy.
Mm-hmm.
So we could be building 50 windmills instead of a new compressor station. We should be actively, it's not that we're not building, it's that we're building the wrong thing. And I'd love to see him and hopefully play on his dream of having a legacy. Because right now, unfortunately, Andrew Cuomo's legacy is that the state is in some ways crumbling and falling apart. Like, we're not actually building, the kind of infrastructure that New York is known for, like the Erie Canal. But so what's the Erie Canal of 2015? It's wind and solar and geothermal.
Well, the infrastructure is something that impacts everyone, and especially upstate New Yorkers. One of the things that would help the upstate economy is building up our infrastructure.
Yeah.
What do you hope to see from, we have two new legislative leaders in the Senate and the Assembly. What do you hope to see them do on day one?
You know, I want to go back to where we were before on corruption. Because the truth is, there's a whole bunch of legislative issues which I would love to see them push. But I want to see them take leadership on fixing ourselves, themselves. Because when you have a broken system, maybe once in a while you can push a good thing through, but the system is still broken. It's like a car that's always turning the wrong direction. Or I had a car once that every time I turned left, the horn went off. wrong. Now, I, you know, you could just you put a little duct tape on that, or you actually have to get in there and fix the fundamental wiring, which is where we had to go. And I think what I'd love to see from these legislative leaders, and we have to demand it, because they're not going to do it on their own, unfortunately. It's too easy, and they're too much a product of the current system. Is I'd like to say to them, say, look, whatever else we do, New York is now becoming a national embarrassment because of its corruption scandals. You know, I teach a class on prosecuting public corruption, and I can count on there being something happening at the courthouse involving Albany because there's a new prosecution every year. It's becoming an embarrassment in its infrastructure because of that. Like, there's real cost. And our education system, which has this unbelievable history, is getting weakened because of the corruption. So I would love to see these leaders say, we are going to be the reform leaders, and we're going to take this on. I will say, I think we're going to have to rely on a lot of the rank-and-file lawmakers standing up against that power, and I know that's hard because you risk getting cut off and losing all access. But if we can see rank-and-file lawmakers coming together and saying, we don't want to be part of a centralized corrupt system. We want to be part of, you know, a legislature that New York can be proud of. That would be very exciting.
Well, one of the things that came out in the trials, as we mentioned, was the complete power in the hands of those leaders, because
yes,
they control the process, that they need to relieve some of that control,
yes,
and give it back to the legislators, because this is a democracy, and they should let democracy happen. And each of the houses has a set of rules that they run the chamber by. And those rules need to be loosened up. And, for example, right now in the Senate, a bill can't come to the floor. I mean, you can't push to have a bill come to the floor unless it has 38 sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
The majority is 32.
Yep.
And even when you have more than that, like you mentioned the bill that had 40,
yeah,
still couldn't get to the floor,
yeah,
because they were holding it up in some committee. They have a rules committee, so oftentimes, or a finance committee, so oftentimes those it might pass your lower level committee, and
yeah,
chair might jump up and down and say, yahoo, we got it through, and then it gets stuck in another committee that's controlled by the leadership.
Access to getting bills to the floor would be one of the most revolutionary things you could do in Albany.
So I think I totally
agree with you.
They should change one of their rules. Should
yeah
be, if you have a majority of sponsors on your bill, the main sponsor of that legislation should have the option to bring that bill to the floor at their request.
That would be, it would be the best kind of earthquake if that happened.
And they could do that on day one.
Yes.
And it doesn't take legislation.
But just to so imagine then, well, it's not hard for you to imagine because you've been there. So how do we then get to those senators and say, you should be pushing this, you should be speaking up about this, because we can't expect the leadership to be pushing this on their own, and say, you should be pushing for this rule change, knowing that if you push for this rule change, all your access is going to get cut off. I think we have to appeal to their sort of fundamental morality.
Well, I think, yes, the individual legislators, but we now have, especially in the Senate, because Dean Skelos automatically lost his seat, there will be a special election at some point. So that seat is vacant.
Yeah.
So the numbers are much more close I think it's like 31 and 31 now. So the four IDC members, Senator Klein and company, have, I think, a really important role that they could possibly play by insisting on some rule changes, because the Republicans are going to need their
help on all kinds of things. But he has actually also been a leader on reform issues in the past, so I do think that's a possibility.
And they have come out with an ethics proposal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, one of their members, Tony Avella, even testified at the Skelos hearing.
Yeah.
And you know, appeared horrified.
Yeah.
At, you know, the system that he's, working in. And I think this is an opportunity for them to come out and say, you know, we want to see some rule changes.
Yeah.
And stand up for that.
Yeah.
Stand up for democracy, for crying out loud.
So if you're speaking to your, the can you see Amador on this rule change?
Well, I don't speak to him, but certainly the residents in this area should certainly be talking to him and to their other elected officials, Senator Marchione. And talk to them about what are you doing personally to make changes. And they will say, oh, we talk about it in our conference, we talk behind closed doors, but when they get to the floor, they are all together. And
one of the real signals of a corrupt system is silence. Because when you hear that silence, nobody ever agrees on anything. When you hear that silence, you know something is wrong. And one of the tragedies of New York State, which again is changeable, is that we have unbelievably low turnout here. And I think it's related to what you're talking about. Because if you don't know what your lawmaker is pushing for because everything's so controlled and it feels like the only people that matter are the leadership and the governor, it's a lot harder to get engaged locally. But if you could go to your local senator and say, hey, if you can get a majority on this, I'm 100% behind you, that changes the incentive for local engagement, which then, people aren't stupid. They vote when they feel like they have more power.
And the system has also, really worked to help benefit those incumbents that are playing the game. Because our redistricting, as you know, thanks to the governor's help, the last redistricting process enshrined even more gerrymandered districts. So you end up with many of these senators and assembly members who've been there a long time, gerrymandered districts that benefit them. I mean, let's face it, they drew a district to benefit George Amador and urged him to run in it. And, who does that?
Yeah.
Nobody drew me a district or you a district.
All I want for Christmas is a specially drawn district.
But so you don't have a lot of, I think there's only like 8 Senate seats that are actually competitive. Where if a Democrat runs, there's a chance that it'll sway back and forth. Like this, the district they added has more Democrats. I don't know what they thought when they were drawing it, but I'm proof that a Democrat could certainly win in this district. So those residents have a lot more power and sway can push those members. Especially a lot of them are new ones. The old, the ones that have been around forever, they're entrenched in districts that are so heavily, Republican, and no one runs against them.
Yeah.
There's no primaries because the machine kind of picks if there's going to be a changeover. It's all kind of organized.
Yeah, I think it's the majority now. When somebody is going to leave office, they resign and then they resign in coordination with local machines so that they can be sure to pick their successor.
Right.
But what you're saying about redistricting is one of the, you asked why I ran against Andrew Cuomo, and I'm a pretty traditional Democrat. I know I have a funny name, but I sort of consider myself a down-the-line traditional Democrat. And one of the complicated things that he did that I think is pretty devastating is he really, really never pushed for serious independent districting that would have led to Democratic power in this state.
That's right. Well, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. I want to thank you, Professor Teachout, for joining me on the Albany Report. I really enjoyed speaking to you. This is the first time we've gotten to chat, and I hope I can have you on again.
I would love to.
And I want you and our listeners to have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
And to you and to all your listeners. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
And we're leaving us. We're leaving the Albany Report with some music, and it is Here Comes the Sun.